my voice doesn't project very well, so if you all fall asleep, you know, think nothing of it. It's okay. I think to live to the 90s, you first have to look at the genetics. My grandmother was born in America to German-Swiss immigrants who had arrived here during the Great Migrations of the 1850s. She was sent to a German school where she learned the three R's to about the third grade level and was also instructed in the household arts, sewing, mending, cooking, care of children, and so forth. Unfortunately, this curriculum did not prepare her for widowhood, with six children ranging in age from infancy to 13 years. At this time, there was no Social Security, no welfare, no family health care, and no effective child labor laws. Things got easier as each child reached 13 or 14 and entered the labor market, adding to the family income. Of the six siblings, one died of cancer at age 40. People were very hush-hush about cancer, even in my day. If a family member got cancer, there was nothing to do but care for them at home until they died. And also, there was so much stigma attached to it, like the victim brought it on themselves, that sort of stuff. And at least we've made a little progress in that area. Well, one died of cancer, two lived to their 80s, and three lived into their 90s. And that was pretty good for those years. I feel I inherited, and I'm grateful for a strong survival component in my DNA. My mother was widowed at age 19, when I was 1 year old. We returned to my grandparents' home, which also included my mother's unmarried sister and teenage brother. Everyone had a job and cared for me when off shift, and I was reputedly spoiled rotten. I don't remember that, of course. Why would I? These relatives were undereducated and overburdened, but that was not an unusual situation for those years. I'm amazed and grateful for their capacity to survive and to model for me their mutual love and support despite their hardships. I attended Catholic grade school, kindergarten through eight. Mostly, I remember the unrelenting discipline of the nuns, and that was necessary to control classes of 50 or more. Later in my life, I realized how much I internalized that discipline, and it did help me to discipline myself when necessary or desirable. I had the good fortune to attend the best public high school for girls in New York City. I particularly remember the unusual balance between cooperation and competition among the students, that is. This school attracted the best teachers. Of course, all teachers love curious, self-disciplined, hardworking kids. I credit these exceptionally talented teachers for an outstanding high school experience. I was raised in the labor movement of the 1930s, and I retain my political bias toward the exploited working classes. I was an adolescent during the Great Depression. I was never homeless or hungry, but nevertheless felt, like most of my friends and fellow students, deprived, angry, and very rebellious. The upside of that experience was that first I learned I could get along with very little if I had to, and still be happy. Second, I had had enough of being poor and never intended to be poor again. Third, I realized that the powerful do not give up power easily one has to be willing to fight effectively for it. During World War II, I worked for about 18 months at Boeing's New Renton plant as an inspector on the wing line. Boeing trained me on site for this job, but because I could not only read and write, but I also knew how to read blueprints. My husband and I worked different shifts, and between us, we were able to care for our young daughter with the help of a nearby neighbor for the shift change. Toward the end of the war, after my son was born, I had the opportunity to work for a real estate mortgage company. With the end of the war in sight, this company was already working on plans for future building and development. My boss was shorthanded and happy to let me learn and be useful. It was an exciting and immensely educational experience for me. Although I am almost completely retired now, I have found helping to provide places for people to live and to work, to be challenging, fulfilling, and also lucrative. With the advances in technology that I've seen, there's an increasing ability to deal with everything from mere discomforts to life-threatening illnesses, and our parents never knew that. Also, modern technology has produced many labor-saving household devices, freeing women for more interesting pursuits. This paved the way for the women's movement, which has affected both men and women. It was a giant step forward for men to have more of an opportunity to participate in their children's lives. To me, the greatest development in television was the invention of the mute button. This enabled me to escape the tyranny of the madmen. Now, those are the Madison Avenue advertising lobby. They were attempting to hypnotize me into buying things I don't need, don't want, don't have room for, and may even be self-destructive. I've enjoyed and relied on my many good friends over the years for mutual support and companionship. To me, one of the hardest parts of living to old age is coping with the loss of my old buddies. And lastly, I think it was a prophet, I think it was Elijah, but I'm not good on the Bible, who asked the rhetorical question, "What does the Lord require of thee? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." Good advice even for us agnostics.
My daughter tells me that she is old. So that makes me very old. Can anybody tell me the definition of wisdom? If I'm old, I'm supposed to be wise. Oh, wait a minute. I'm getting ahead of my story here. I was born to very conservative Midwestern parents who programmed me to believe that I would marry and have children. Well, I tried that for 24 and a half years, but it didn't work very well, so I decided to look for meanings in life. Meantime, one of the girls in my discussion group dedicated a song to me that ended with these words, "You only have to learn to love and be loved in return." It occurred to me, well, maybe that's what it's all about. Starting with one-on-one relationships, and how does it play in the world? Based on some old memories, I began to search the public library for word meanings. Do you know that there are several words in the English language that mean nothing and everything, both? God and love are prime examples of this type of word. Love has five distinct meanings, which are clearly delineated in books. Romantic love, unconditional love, compassion, friendship, and agape. Romantic love, you probably know more about it than I do. We often hear a discussion about eros, and that, of course, is the passion of romantic love. But there's also a lot of playfulness and creativity in romantic love. Unconditional love is marked by its acceptance, nurturing, and guidance. Sometimes you have to sever ties if you're going to have a life worth living if your developed concepts differ too radically from your parents. Timothy McVeigh was put to death for bombing the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, which killed 168 people. Yet, during the penalty phase of that trial, his mother pleaded with the jury, "He's not a monster. He's a human being." This type of unconditional love can also be applied to tribal lives, to nations. Just think what our world would be like if all the national leaders thought what their actions were going to be causing, and also applied a little forgiveness along the way. Compassion needs no further explanation than, "But there, but for the grace of God, go I." Friendship love is the bond that develops between people who work for a common cause. Since all knowledge is from God, He wants us to know all we can. No strings attached, no judgment. This is agape. That's what we come to church to learn about. Even if you don't believe in God, if you reach out with understanding and caring, you're being a child of God. If each of us applied some of those concepts from love to all of our relationships, this world would be a different place indeed. In my search for meaning, I came across another book called Habits of Love by Ed Bacon. Ed Bacon served as the rector of the Urban Episcopal Parish in Pasadena for 15 years. Bacon teaches us that the inner core, the places that we don't see, are all goodness and love. He also teaches us that if we practice, get that, practice stillness, generosity, forgiveness, compassion, community, and truth, that the core of our being will come forth and overcome our fears. Since I'm a meditator, I can recommend that stillness does help us to know ourselves, and that gives us our inner core, the opportunity, just the opportunity to express. William James says, "The greatest revolution of our generation is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their lives, can change the outer aspects of their lives." So, I can only recommend the words of the song, You only have to learn to love and be loved in return as a way to function in life. Thank you.
Well, I find the older I get, the more I wonder. I don't know very much. I was looking for my wisdom to start with, and I decided that I didn't know where that was. I have had an older sister that was born the same year that the Wright brothers flew their first little airplane at Kitty Hawk. I was born some years later, about 6 months after the armistice was signed, ending the Great War, World War I, the war that was so horrible that they talked about having a League of Nations, a safe place where the countries could come together and talk out their differences, and the world would never have to go through such a terrible experience, such a costly occurrence again. The other day, I was looking through some stuff that I have, sort of a junk drawer, and I came across a stone. And this stone had been with me for at least 50 years, and how it has stuck by me with all my travels and so forth, and not paying very much attention to it. And here is this stone that I picked up on the shore of Lake Michigan in the days when I was spending long summers up there. And it's the kind of a stone that people find as you're just walking along, rather rarely. But it's like people pick up agates as they're going along. But I happened to have a geologist friend that lived down the hall this time. And so I took it to him the other day and I said, "What can you tell me about this stone?" And he takes it and he says, "Oh, this is a special stone." He says, "It's 400 million years old." And he takes out a piece of paper and he writes down 400 zero, 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 zero. Well, that's a considerable amount and you to hold in your hand. Is there a picture of it?
Yeah.
Anyway, what he says is, this is a well-worn, a water-worn limestone. It comes from a time when the North American continent was submerged in a tropical sea, and there was coral growing upright, and this is a slice of coral. And you know, to hold in your hand something that is that old, and you think of periods of time and ages of time and civilizations and Dark Ages and Middle Ages and kingdoms and dynasties and so forth. All of them sort of built up and then destroyed. Seems like there have been just cycles of time that have been built up but always destroyed. It's just a very interesting thing to hold in your hand. But one thing that's been fascinating to me lately, a period of time, is the idea that two ordinary people can come together and ignite a spark that 9 months later can appear as a package, 7 to 12 pounds, heavens, more or less easily, the size that you can hold in two hands. And this is something that I really got to wondering about. and I don't want any lectures on anatomy. If this is not accurate, I don't want to know about it. I prefer my fantasy. But I see this package with all the pieces and movable parts that are specifically designed to go to different areas and to grow and develop and hum along kind of automatically. People don't pay any attention to it. You think of this package, if there were just one of them, how valuable it would be. People would be so amazed. It would be a curiosity. It would be so valued. But there are a dime a dozen. There's a million of them. They all got here the same way. If they were not such an awkward shape, you could fit them together like spoons in a drawer. Well, you know, they're acceptable casualties as you're planning your next battle. There's a certain number that you figure you can afford to waste. Now I've lost my place. But anyway, it never occurs to people to be grateful for such a gift. These parts go on and all are available all your life. There are some parts that are only available at certain ages. Children cannot light the spark. Elders, not to cope with it. And then as time goes on, you begin to have trouble with it. And that's when we start paying attention to some of our parts. Some of them can be repaired, some of them cannot. Some of them can be exchanged. Some of them you can have artificial. They're just amazing. But one thing that surprises me is that of these things, where we are so much alike, if it was sort of a closed circle, I see it as a closed circle, we would be robots. We'd all do the same kind of thing. But somehow in this intricate design, one part was left open. And I have thought that that's kind of strange, particularly as this all comes with no instructions, no directions. And here's this open part. Until you realize that this is where the potential is. This is where the possibilities are. This is where the abilities to learn and to adapt and to cooperate and to do all the special things that people do as they grow older. They've got a whole Pandora's box full of possibilities at that time. And there are modifications that can be made. Look at the change in the hand when they developed the opposable thumbs to be able to grasp, to be able to hurl, to be able to grasp a tool, to build and to dig. The brain also has evolved and modified. To go back to the Wright brothers, and the look at the improvements that have come as far as the airplane is concerned. The skills to build a sophisticated machine such as an airplane, such as a computer. Then we look at what has happened to the League of Nations. Now we have a United Nations. It's got a 39-story building on 16 acres in New York. 192 nations signed on. And the place And there are all sorts of different departments and bureaus that do deal with worldwide concerns. But the assembly, where the people debate the concerns of the world, we're on a pretty primitive level, it seems to me. We don't want to give up our stuff. We don't want to let other people in our club. We really kind of prefer to spy on and to strategize about the stuff that other people have, compared to the sophisticated skills taken to keep the airplane up in the sky. We're far behind as it comes to the skills that it takes in human relations. It seems to me that maybe we need some modification of the heart more than the brain in order to help us get along together. Meantime, my little stone reminds us that the earth is changing also and is capable of pretty dramatic change. And maybe we're going to have to learn to cooperate and to deal with each other in a more helpful, cooperative way.